Hello and welcome everyone to a very special and hopefully the exact video format that we want for our very special MTG Potpourri podcast, which is arguably about magic roughly 16% of the time. The other 84% is watching Conley and Adam drink random beverages.
that's correct.
And I'm going to assume it is water. Okay. I don't believe you, but
Adam will have some alcohol of some type.
Yeah, and he was rocking Diet Dr. Pepper. I think he was keeping it fairly low key today.
Yeah, we're took it down a level. It's not a lambic beer, not even close. Not even in the same ballpark of terrible dairy analogies to use. We're all right.
But now that we are doing,
I would argue for like 60-40 magic though. Like 16 seems too low.
Yeah, I agree. Diet Dr. Pepper is like an almond milk, and then sometimes you need to go outside the box and you need to get the sheep's milk.
Wait, are you, sheep's, you're not dissing Diet Dr. Pepper. Just
no, I drink.
Okay. We were gonna fight. That's why I just want to make sure you knew.
Exclusively almond milk.
So what's your thoughts on Diet Cherry Dr. Pepper then?
I don't know because I don't really drink soda anymore. And Diet Cherry Dr. Pepper is not something I've drank many times, maybe once or twice in my life.
Are you serious? I haven't at least.
That's not as, you. First of all, I'd have to drink Diet to drink that. And I've only, when I've drank Diet, like, it was not exotic things. It was like Diet 25-cent soda from Walmart. And they did not have wild.
Like Diet Dr. Thunder and all the weird.
Yeah, like crap. Like, so I didn't get any fancy name brand stuff. So I grew up pretty poor.
Well, I wasn't asking about your childhood, but that's cool if you want to go there.
I'm just saying, when I've been an adult, I don't have to drink a ton of soda. I'm not a huge soda fan. And then when I am drinking soda, it's not Diet. So
when he does, though, he drinks Faygo Cola. Have you ever had a Faygo?
No.
It's like a Coca-Cola brand. And the cans are apparently, they're made of like 110 grade steel. They're the heaviest can you'll ever feel. You could bludgeon somebody to death with a Faygo Cola can.
What kind of podcast are we?
Okay. This is a magic podcast. I'm your host, Tom, bringing you this.
I just wanted you to say it. I don't even know if we got through all of our introductions.
No, we didn't. So I'm Tom, hosting the podcast. I'm not sure where, when people are watching it, I'm not sure if they're going to be right to my left. We have Conley Woods joining us.
That'd be me.
With his bachelor pad, but well-staged background to his video feed. What is in your trophy? It looks like there's like a man purse in your trophy back there.
No, that's my semifinalist world plaque.
Oh, it's a plaque. Okay. Yeah, you wouldn't want to hang that up.
And well, I had it hung up and it fell off the wall multiple times and was starting to destroy things. So.
You understand what a wall anchor is, or am I talking to an uninitiated person?
No, I do understand what a wall anchor is, but the problem is this is an apartment with shitty walls and the wall was peeling back because the thing's too heavy. So it would literally just rip out the drywall.
With a wall anchor?
No, I didn't get a giant wall anchor. You can't put those in without.
Yeah, I didn't know if your walls made of like toothpaste and Swiss cheese.
This particular wall is, yes.
It is.
I have a picture up here that's like of ships, and it was barely able to get up there. I ripped part of the wall out too, which is not.
And our construction expert who does understand wall anchors is we have Adam Siborski with us.
Well, it's debatable. I guess I understand what wall anchors are for. I just have a problem with actually putting them in the right spot. So in my living room, like anybody who would ever track me down and kind of break in and, you know, surprise me at my house, please don't do that.
If you look at the main window
in the living room, there's the big hanging bar with like the window curtains or whatever. And you look at the one side and there's two extra wall anchors just like kind of like chilling out like an inch off of the bar because I just didn't put them in the right spot.
Yeah, well, you could take – well, I guess you – depends what kind of wall anchor you use. I don't know if you ever use like –
They're not the kind that you take back out.
Oh, okay. All right. Guys, this is a magic podcast. We might actually talk about a little bit about magic before I talk about Wolf Cop towards the end of the episode, which I finally got to see. Do you remember me talking about Wolf Cop when it was announced, the werewolf detective? Office?
No.
Yeah, it's great. Filmed in Canada.
I tried to repress those memories.
Finally came on DVD, so I was able to get my hands on it. So, guys, we actually do have a couple of magic news items. Not a ton, because this is always sort of that calm that's the center of the hurricane, the eye of the storm. Because whenever a new set comes out, we just had our pre-releases and release tournaments, usually there's not a ton of news coming out at that point. Unless you're talking about formats. And I guess, Adam, you probably want to talk about a potentially a contentious rule change. in format that you like. Now, are you going to write an article on this for like the official Mothership?
I mean, I'm gonna call it out in my article. Just point out that this is a rule change and kind of do the requisite links and stuff to it. But basically, if you've been living under a magic rock, or you have your social media filter to just automatically hide or ignore any mention of Commander. Basically, this past week there was a rule change where tuck cards. So things like there's a whole bunch of them. I never really played tuck cards, so I have trouble remembering them off the top of my head. Chaos Warp, I think is one of them. Basically, it's just any effect where your commander would end up. what are you doing?
This is the most distracting thing I've ever seen.
Does that show up backwards?
No,
it's no one was going to
see you. So you can read it, because on my little video feed, it's all backwards. It looks like Leonardo da Vinci wrote a card.
It looks perfectly normal. Just
okay,
like your
cool. Okay, so that's better. I didn't know if you looked like you were reading Greek.
Yeah, so I was just having next level derailment here.
Okay.
So the Ancient Commander is basically this. Any effect that would say, hey, put your commander... shuffle it into your library or put it on the bottom of your library face down. Any of those effects are generally called tuck effects. And so basically just did away with that. They're like, hey, if that would happen, just instead you can put it back in the command zone. So that's how it's worked for like the graveyard and for exile. Like anytime it would enter that zone, just as like a replacement effect, basically, it's like you just put it in the command zone instead. And you can cast it back out of there again for its additional mana. So that was the change. It was just basically, hey, you know, this is kind of weird. This seems, you know, out of place. Like the kind of the argument, the general thrust of the arguments have been pretty straightforward. For I mean, basically, Sheldon Menery, one of the members of the Commander Rules Committee, was basically just like, yeah, it's just like a lot of people use tutors to get their commanders back out of their decks. They felt like they were naked without a tutor to get it back, because if you tuck my commander, I can't do anything. Or I can't use my commander anymore. And they were just like, it just doesn't make sense in the context of the format where just you should always have your commander. And so this sort of very straightforward, you know, sounds like a reasonable thing. Like, this one weird way to not let a commander go back to the command zone. They just finally fixed that. That sounds like a loophole, right? In a format where you're supposed to always have your commander, having a way to not have your commander sounds like a terrible idea. And so obviously this was not regarded as a terrible idea. This was something that everybody seemed to love, and they really went overboard on social media. Just a lot of people came out saying that this is a terrible rules change, that the inability to tuck commanders means the entire format is now degenerate, and games are just completely broken because you can't get rid of some commanders by putting them inside of a library. That's the kind of general social media sentiment, if that's what you read.
There's a couple. I mean, there were some other like points brought up, like to counter the people run tutors to get their commanders out. Like, that's just bull crap. Like, people run tutors because tutors are powerful and because they grab cards. Do they grab your commander if it gets tucked? Absolutely. But people are running those tutors regardless of whether or not commanders get tucked. Like, in this new format, I would 100% guarantee the number of tutors will be exactly the same. Maybe Time of Need sees a little bit less play, but that's about it. But you're still playing your demonic tutors, your vampire tutors. Like, there's no way you're cutting those from your commander decks. It's a singleton format. You want tutors. Like, that. So that argument, I think, is bunk. But I totally agree that the heart, like, the intent of the format from the beginning was that the commander is something you always have access to. That's why if it gets killed or put in a new graveyard for any reason, you put it in your command zone. The idea that it gets tucked only existed on a couple of cards at the time that commander was invented. It has been things that put things on top or bottom of your library have increased over time. But if you look back at the old days of Magic, there were not a lot of things that shuffled cards in your library. So it probably just wasn't a thing that even came up on the radar as like a relevant rules change. It's like, let's add this little piece of token text to the end of if your commander goes to the graveyard or is put into your library, you may exile it. So I agree that like the tuck rule, as this is being called to parallel the NFL,
it tucks medicated pads. That's why I think every time I hear this.
Well, no, it's funny to call it the tuck rule because the tuck rule in football is also extremely controversial and was a big debate.
What?
Which is the, if you're going to throw the football, you don't know what the tuck rule is.
No, that's why I was raising my hand, because I had a question.
Yeah, if the quarterback is going to make a forward motion with their arm and it is hit out of their arm, like their arm is hit by an enemy opponent, and the ball goes flying. It is deemed a forward pass if their hand is going forward as opposed to going back, and then there's like it's just complicated stuff. But
it was about this video replay. That'd just be yeah.
Well, you can use video replay, so.
Okay, apparently I haven't watched enough football.
Okay, all right, anyway. but I think that this rule really goes with the intent of the format as it originally was created, although I can totally agree that some commanders are extremely powerful and extremely difficult to deal with and without, quote-unquote, the tuck rule. So I think there's some changes need to occur to balance that out, whether it's banning those commanders or possibly coming up with some other way for the commanders to be dealt with or whatever. I think the tuck rule still makes them cost more, right? Like, if you spin in to miss something, it still increases its cost by two. Is that correct, Adam?
No, because effectively you just draw it to your hand and then cast it like normal. So it's not casting it from the command zone. Yeah, the command zone is just where the commander goes, and so every time it goes back there, every additional time you cast it from the command zone, it costs an additional two colorless. So that's the extra rule. So if it gets spin in the myth and you draw it, you just cast it like normal.
No. But if spin in the myth, I want to put it on the bottom of your library.
Sure. And then I tutor it back to my hand. I just cast it.
I'm saying in the new world, if I spin in the myth, put it on the bottom of your library, does it go to the command zone or where does it go?
You can let it go to the bottom of the library, but you probably just replace it, go back to the command zone, and it costs an additional two
to
cast.
Okay. So if something would be tucked, it can go to the command zone. That's the rule?
Right. Yeah, basically okay, it just says, hey, if the commander would, you know, it's just a new replacement rule. Like as far as I'm aware, like, all the commander rules now can just be, like, simplified down to one thing. If your commander's on the battlefield, and it would change zones, you may instead put it in the command zone, just as a blanket replacement rule. That's pretty much how commanders work now. Like, there's very, very few ways. Like, I can't even think of a card right now in the game that somehow doesn't let you get your commander back with the way the tuck, with the new tuck rule, basically.
Oblivion Ring puts it in the command zone.
Well, Oblivion Ring exiles it, but instead of going to exile, you can choose to put it in your command zone. Just okay. Anytime it would, you know. I mean, the only zones it can move to, I think the only way it can go somewhere else is just a straight up boomerang. Maybe that's it. I think that's the only place that the commander can go. That's the only zone a commander can move to is your hand, and yeah. It doesn't. You don't get to replace it.
But that it saves you two mana because you need to cast it.
Yeah.
So I was just trying to think of things like, you know, kind of memory jar and stuff. But do they all use the word exile now? Like, say I have my commander in my hand. And something comes along as a new...
Well, it doesn't matter, because if it gets discarded, it goes to command zone. If it gets put in your library, it gets command zoned. If it gets exiled, it goes to command zone, so you can have it do any of those.
Okay.
And there's no other place that your hand could go.
I guess...
Right. Well, the commander rule only works when it's a commander, when it's a creature card on the battlefield. So I'm pretty sure that it doesn't work. So if I bounce something to your hand, I may be wrong here. It's, you know, as far as I'm aware, there's no like commander to hand rule. Like if I just boomerang your commander straight up and then make you discard your hand, like your commander ends up in the graveyard and there's not a lot of you can do about it.
Oh, that's weird. Why wouldn't they just make the rule cover all that then? Like,
right, that's what I mean. It's like, I feel like we're just a step shy of just like having just a blanket replacement effect. Like, hey, if your commander would change zones, you may instead choose to put it in your command zone. Like, that should just be the commander rule. Like, and it just covers everything. And I feel like that's what the command... That's how the format was always supposed to be.
Huh. At least the intent form. I mean, I like the idea of kind of unifying and making it more simple, because to me, I still view commander as a casual format that's, in my mind, to be played for fun, just to have kind of interesting card interactions. I like the idea that, as Adam just put it, if they can just sort of unify it, simplify it, that no matter what happens to my commander, if it's going to go somewhere else, I can go plop it in the command zone.
Yeah, I honestly already thought it was more unified. I didn't realize that there was that many holes in it, which makes me wonder why they wouldn't just patch everything up at once. Like, it's kind of weird.
Probably because people are, you know, crapping ruck eggs right now. Mile change.
But when you take the extreme, so this was the extreme, right? The way you deal with commanders was to put it onto somebody's bottom of somebody's library or whatever, and they can't figure it out. Now that doesn't exist, the new way to deal with commanders is to bounce it and then wheel or break your memory jar or have them discard their hand to a Persecute or something like that. Like, there's just a new way to deal with commanders that was not intended, and if people start to use that way because it's now the only way, then they're going to have to go, oh, we screwed up, we have to go back and fix this thing because commanders are being put in people's libraries and graveyards when they're not intended to, and you end up in the same world. Like, the reason that the Tuck cards are used so often is because they're the easiest way to deal with commanders, and now theoretically, if there's still a way to deal with them that gets out of the command zone, people are just going to turn to that. Theoretically, I don't know if they will, and then what they're going to have to readdress it.
Yeah, so to kind of pivot off of that, you know, if it wasn't clear from like my explanation, like I find a lot of the argumentation online, I'm pretty incredulous of it. Like, people are way like, this is a very classic Magic player thing happening right now. Like, wait, they made this dramatic change. What do you mean damage doesn't use the stack? They're dumbing down the game. This is the worst thing ever. It's going to break these creatures. Look at all this stuff that's happening. It's fine. It is totally fine. Because at the end of the day, three things are happening. One, the format makes a little more sense, right? The reason Tuck cards were so powerful wasn't because they dealt with a narrowly set portion of commanders, right? Most of the Tuck cards still targeted, so they didn't handle things like Xur, which just immediately makes himself hexproof or shroud, or Earl, which already has hexproof. You know, it's that putting creatures not in the graveyard and not into somebody's hand was just the best value possible, because there are so many ways to abuse creature cards in the graveyard. There are so many ways to generate mana that literally just putting it into the library was just the safest place to put it. That's what makes Tuck cards great, and they're still good. Like, it's not like all of a sudden all the value on the Tuck cards is just plummeted overnight because like they're only played in Commander for this. It's like Chaos Warp is still great. It's still a really great way to deal with like Phyrexian Colossus or whatever, or to get rid of like some super annoying creature that you don't want to be able to let, you know, player B next to you reanimate. Like, they're still great. So Tuck cards are still good. They're still useful for tons of great removal. The thing about the reason I brought up the thing about tutors is that was like probably the most hollow excuse I ever heard for players that are like, I don't really like tutors, but I want to be able to get my commander back if it gets tucked. And, like, that's not really what they were running the tutors for. They're running for exactly the same reason I run a couple tutors in most of my decks, the same reason you pointed out tutors are so great in a singleton format, Conley, is because people just like to be able to find powerful cards when they need them. And that's okay. Yeah. Like, you know, how you use a tutor, right, harkens to the whole reason Commander exists, and that's the social contract. It's all about, can I play a game of Magic that I enjoy with these other people that they also enjoy? That's really kind of the oversimplified version of it. And so for like a lot of us, it's like, I like to see wacky things, and I like to see kind of big splashy creatures pop up, and you know, that kind of hits at what Tom talked about. And other players, and a pretty large group of them, actually like these really high-powered games where it's like these almost like puzzle-like states, where it's like this back-and-forth, like, almost like fencing, where like both players are constantly going for the kill and kind of juking around each other back and forth. You know, and I think that's a little less what Commander is really all about, but that's still kind of part of Commander. And so there's just this huge overlap of players that like super powerful cards doing super powerful things, and they feel like the Tuck rule just like makes the subset of these super powerful cards, like commanders like Derevi, that can just always come back for 4 mana. Like, that's his thing. And, oh, when he comes on the battlefield, he untaps something. So it's just like, oh, well, whoops, I can't Tuck Derevi and undo this, you know, unlimited mana combo now. Like, that's just always going to happen. Well, if you're playing against somebody who's doing that, and that's not fun for anyone else except for that player, you probably should have a conversation about that. Like, that's not a problem with the format. That's a problem with how your group is engaging. And that's really what it all comes down to is at the end of the day, it's much easier to point to other things and say, well, I run tutors because my commander can't tuck. Or I need to be able to tuck commanders because somebody else does something really dangerous with it. It's not owning the fact that, hey, I'm contributing to this experience. And how I contribute to it matters to the players that I'm playing with. And if I'm not owning my contribution to that and ensuring that, yes, I do fun and powerful things, and maybe even I have really cool, scary 11/11 trample, infect, indestructible dude, great, like that's terrifying, and I just kill people in one hit, sure. But if other players aren't enjoying that game, it's up to me to reevaluate that. And that's what the social contract's about. And that just kind of got lost in this whole shuffle, is that at the end of the day, there were groups that already weren't using tucks, where they said, well, the Tuck rule, tucking commanders is really dumb, like that doesn't make sense, that's not what the format's about, so that just doesn't happen. And those groups have been fine.
I would just like to let it be known that I do, in fact, Chuck.
Thank you, Conley. Thank you.
Okay, I didn't know if anybody else was thinking of Silence of the Lambs every time you hear the word Tuck come out.
Of course. Oh, man. Of course. The jokes are thick.
I do.
We're talking about tucking.
The jokes aren't the only thick thing around here.
I put some lotion on his skin or it gets the hose.
And then that's why I've been quiet about it. Because, like, at the end of the day, like I could put my opinion out there, and it's basically just like, look, you're all, one, overreacting, and two, probably not playing the format right as it is. Like, just, you know, if you need a whole bunch of tutors and answers to completely debilitate a narrow subset of commanders that are genuinely terrifying to deal with, and you need those in all of your decks, and the format's no fun without that way to play, I don't think you're really approaching Commander right. And that's just how I feel about it. And it's a very strong opinion, and I appreciate that some people disagree with that, and they've got some very eloquent ways to talk about that, and oftentimes a lot of not eloquent ways to talk about it, as I've seen on Twitter. So I just stay clear of it. But that's just how it is at the end of the day. Like, Commander is supposed to be able to let you play your Commander. If the worst thing to come out of this is we have to ban a couple of Commanders, like, that would be the worst, right? Like, oh, we have, like, four new Commanders that we just can't use as Commanders. They just... We can put them on our decks, but we can't use them as our commander. So if that's the worst that happens out of this, but players come to the format and, like, they don't get sideswiped by these crazy, like, oh, you can't use your commander now, even though, like, you just built your entire deck around this thing, and that's everything we've all talked about for the past week as you were built your deck for the first time. I'm fine banning four commanders from being commanders if that's all that really comes from this rule change. Like, and I think at the end of the day, that's totally fine. And I don't understand what everybody's really going to town about.
And so, for me, just for kind of like from a curiosity standpoint, now that Commander is sort of this officially recognized format, but it has this weird history of being this self-created by players at its own rules committee, what is the process of somebody of getting a rule change for Commander? Because does Wizards have input? Does Sheldon Menry's, you know, quorum of Dragon Elders have input? Like, what's the pathway?
Well, I mean, it's all outside of Wizards. So, like, typically, like, you know, like, let's compare it to Standard, right? So everybody knows how a card gets banned at Standard. Everybody complains about it. It turns out the entire format becomes, are you pro this card or anti this card? And then R&D goes, yeah, this is problematic. We're just not going to have this card available. So everybody can play something that's not just this card or something that deals with this card or this mechanic. You know, in the case of Affinity, when they kind of went through the last banning. But, like, Jace and the Stoneforge Mystic was, like, the most recent Standard banning. And I don't think anybody really misunderstood why that kind of needed to happen. You know, there's a little bit of ruffled feathers. There always is, because some people really like using those cards and winning and playing. And they are fun cards to play.
Some people are just anti-banning, period.
Yeah, it's just like, well, this card's in the game, and we should deal with it, because, like, my win record's now 70%. So this is everyone else's problem. Like, that was the crux of some of people's arguments, from what I remember. So, like, that comes from both having a ton of tournament data, right? High-level, professional REL play involving these cards, looking at the deck list, looking at the format, and internal, very, you know, smart people that are making the game coming to the decision to say, hey, this is something that's genuine and healthy for the format. Like, you know, Birthing Pod and Treasure Cruise and Modern are kind of maybe in a little bit of a different boat. You know, Eternal formats.
I like that.
But, like, Standard's a great example, Cruise. Right? Like, it's pretty clear cut if something's really demonstratingly bad in the format. Yes. In Commander, it's totally different, right? There aren't tournaments. There aren't deck lists. There isn't professional play. There is really no sort of mass amount of gameplay data, results-oriented gameplay data, that tells you, is something broken or not? What are we holding up here, Conley? I still can't read it.
Pull it back a little bit.
Yeah. Can you just read it out loud?
A little bit more. Something about happy ending? What?
It says you will go on a happy adventure soon. That was my fortune cookie for the day. I just wanted to pull a Tom and distract you.
Nice. So, I like it.
I like happy adventures.
Maybe it's Vegas. Maybe that's the one.
Watch out.
Why are you pulling out your wallet?
Because there's weird shit in here, that's why.
I got a wallet too. Look. Woo.
That's weird shit.
it's really thin.
If you want to play the weird stuff in the desk game, we got earplugs.
No, I had Chinese food for dinner. It wasn't that weird, David. I'm like,
so the thing about Commander is, like, nobody sees, like, there's no data to use to argue with, right? It's all anecdotal. It's all my experience. It's all my playgroup this. It's all what I've seen at Grand Prix or side events, right? So it's very nebulous. And then it actually is just a cadre of individuals, the Commander's Rule Committee, that come to these decisions, right? And so it's not like they're not all, like, public figures and you can't talk to them and provide feedback and thoughts and stuff like that. But it's like, it isn't like some sort of, like, very public process based on a whole bunch of evidence that you can point to that says, hey, we're making this change or banning this card. And so I think that's a lot of what just drives the discussions is just people are like, I don't see where this is coming from. I have nothing I can see that points to this. And that's not my experience with the format. Therefore, it must be wrong. Yeah, and that's kind of like the end of the story. Yeah, that's what makes Commander bans weird, is there's nothing to point to.
I win Wiimote and then check.
What about this? This is youth-boosting hair formula.
Do I need to ask what kind of hair you put that on?
It's just for, like, makes your hair look fuller and more.
Oh, it's, okay, I didn't know if you were doing some sort of, like, bonsai trimming or something.
No.
So Tom, to answer your question.
I made it through that entire conversation and stayed on topic, by the way. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, I was impressed, Adam.
I don't know if, like, nobody, like, everyone else gets to listen to what he was saying while watching us act like idiots. I literally have no idea what Adam said because I was focused on what the hell I was going to pick up in my
So good Tom, job, Adam. If you decided you wanted a commander, if you wanted something banned or a rule changed, what you would do is you would talk about it on the official forums at mtgcommander.net, I believe.
Yep.
And you could provide that feedback to members of the rules committee, like Toby Elliott, Sheldon Menery, Devin Rule, guys like that, that can take that thought into consideration. Like, there's no, like, you know,
it's kind of like lobbying.
Is really the best comparison. Okay. Is you talk to the people that can make the decisions, you try to convince them of your point of view, and hope for the best. And that's kind of the best you can do if you want to make some sort of sweeping change to the format.
For what it's worth, I work with Devin Rule, so I can get you the inside track if you need it, Tom.
Okay. It just seems so crazy that there's this one kind of officially, you know, accepted format that WotC has no control over. It's very unusual to me.
Well, it's not that they have no – I mean, the people who are on this committee have direct ties with WotC. Like, Sheldon Menery was the highest-level judge. He worked for WotC for an infinite number of years. He's got a bunch of people and friends inside of WotC that are giving them their opinions all the time. And he's, like – it's not like there's, like, zero influence from WotC. WotC has plenty of influence over this type of stuff if they want to. But they also trust that this group of people will do what's best for the community. And I'm sure that if they want their voices heard, they'll go, hey, Sheldon, here's the ideas that we have, blah, 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 blah. Blah. I'm sure they're not just sitting back and, like, going, oh, blah, 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 like, the world's falling apart.
Oh, hell no.
About it. But at the same time, they also have some level of trust going, we're not going to spend a ton of time investing in this format when we already have some people who are super passionate about it and super enthusiastic about it that want to be doing that for us. We're just going to let them take control of it. Like, imagine if they did that same thing for Magic Online. We would have awesome effing Magic Online. But instead, they're forcing it, and they're putting too much on their plate, and we have fucking Magic Online that we have right now.
Has there been any recent kerfuffles with that, or?
Yeah, it's terrible. What do you mean?
Like, that's not. Well, see, I'll argue that that's not new.
Literally, every time you log on to Magic Online, there will be some type of new bug that will disrupt your play. Like, it just becomes so commonplace that people don't complain about it all the time. While I'm recording a video, my Magic Online will shut down 6 to 7 times. Like, it is absurd. I have to record a video when I'm done with this, and I'm expecting, like, used to be able to set aside 2.5 hours for a draft, like, maybe 3 hours for an 8-man constructed, whatever, including, like, a video beforehand. Now, I honestly have no idea how long my video is going to take, because sometimes the whole program crashes in the middle, and I can't even keep the content that I made. Sometimes I'm not able to open my trade binder for 3 or 4 hours just because there's just a bug that just says, if you go in your trade binder, we shut down. So, like, literally at one point in time, I was working on my deck doctor, and I was like, I need to acquire cards so I could do this deck doctor. And every trade screen I entered, Magic Online would shut down. So I just couldn't buy tickets from the store or trade with people. So I was just like, for 4 hours, it was like, and then the fifth hour, I logged back on, the bug was gone and everything was fine. I didn't do anything. I didn't report it. It's just like those types of things. And I understand there's a ton of growing pains and they're working and stuff like that. I understand that, you know, it's not simple. Like, we could push a button to fix this, but at the same time, it's very, very frustrating when you have, you know, a game doing as well as it is with the online equivalent still just not even close.
So basically, Magic Online is still in status quo, Tom, just to translate all of that. However, I do want to point out one thing, because people don't like to always talk about the good stuff, because,
I can tut. It's hard.
So one of the things that they're actually testing right now are 6/4s payouts. So before it was always just like 4/3, 2/2 or whatever it is, but like there are now events where it's like a 6/4 instead of like a 5/4 payout. So like theoretically, if you get to the finals, you could perfectly split the product, and it also pays out slightly more than it did before. That was my understanding of the change. Is that correct, Conley?
Wait, so your understanding is that 6/4s replace 4/3, 2/2s?
No, that the finals payout of a 6/4 is a new payout amount that's different from what 5/4 used to be.
Sure, but I was under the impression that it was a brand new payout and like 8/4s will still exist.
Right. Yeah, they're testing this different one where it's a slightly different payout, even though it goes a little deeper than an 8/4 payout.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's like 6/4, 1/1 or something like that. I don't even know. But yeah, I don't know. I'm fine with them. Like, there should be a ton of more customizability on Magic Online, just because it's something that they could basically just move a few numbers around and it's fixed. Like, they don't need to program it. It's not going to cause a lot of chaos. The reason you have less types of queues is simply that you want people to actually be joining the queues. So if I had, 25 different types of legacy queues, for example, the chances that any one two-man legacy queue fires is so low because everyone else is joining other ones. So that's the incentive to work against that. But when it comes to limited, people are going to go towards the queues that make the most sense. So you have these queues that are currently being split up by skill level. That's basically what we've assigned it. If you're a good player, you go to 8/4. If you're a medium player, you go to 4/3, 2/2. If you're a crappy player, you go to Swiss. And because of the way that PAX pay out online, and because of the way that the breakdowns in PAX for prizes don't actually match up right now, there are a ton of incentives that actually make that weird trichotomy, I guess it is, of skill levels not correct. Like, if you're looking for maximum payout, you should be joining XQ. If you're looking for, like, for me, for example, when I go to record a video, I'm technically supposed to join a Swiss queue because it guarantees I can play all 3 rounds so I can have the most content, but skill level wise, joining a Swiss queue isn't necessarily reflective of like what I should be showing people. So it's kind of this weird tension where it's like, I need to join 8/4s and I need to win both rounds to get to the final round. Otherwise, I'm losing out on content. But if I'm joining any other queue that guarantees that content, I'm not playing against necessarily the skill level. So there's just like really weird incentives that kind of clash. And I think having some more fleshed out and obvious cues to people, like, this is the queue I should be joining because it does this for me, would be awesome, as opposed to these kind of like mathematical hidden, like, you need to figure out the payout per person and the payout per position and how many cards you're opening up and how many rounds you're getting to play. Like, all those things have different values to people, and I think they're all basically hidden right now, and you kind of have to feel it out for yourself, and it kind of makes it a mess. So I would like to see that cleaned up a little bit and things just expressed a little bit neater in the future. It's not a super high priority, so I understand why it hasn't been done, since they need to make Magic Online better first, but that would be something that I think would be awesome. And 6/4s are just like a stepping stone towards that, just like opening up the possibility of changing up the current structure.
So there's a sliver of good news, Tom.
Okay, that's good. All. I want to be positive, so I was hoping for something there. Every once in a while, even in the shitstorm, there's got to be that one little spot where there's just less shit than the other.
No, I mean, they're making small improvements all the time. The problem is that no matter how many improvements they make, we expected all those improvements to occur so long ago that we all feel let down regardless of the good moves they're making. Because it's like, yes, you're making good moves, but why didn't this happen 3 years ago, 5 years ago even? And so it's not that they're not doing good things. It's just that there's still this built-up tension and frustration that we have that has not been released and will not be released until Magic Online is completely reformed.
And that's
so unfortunately, there's going to be negativity.
I mean, Magic players know a lot about that pent-up frustration. It's well understood. I was going to Google it, but does anybody know off their head like when the first client for Magic the Gathering Online was available? I mean, like, how long? And you just kind of mentioned, we were thinking these things maybe would be fixed years ago. Like, how long has this program been out at this point?
The very first Magic Online was like 99 or 2000, something like
that. Really?
Yeah, I thought it came out.
It was really old.
Odyssey Block, because like Onslaught Block or Invasion Block was available for a very short period of time before it tipped over. That's what I recall.
Okay.
From 2002. I'm looking it up.
That is kind of shocking if there still is a lot of, when you talk about a program that is theoretically 13, you know. I mean, kids were born.
2003.
Kids were born in this program.
June 2002.
So kids were born when this game program came out and now could be avid players, and it's still, that's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and it was only available for Windows then, obviously.
What version of Windows?
It could only hold 2,000 to 4,000 people at a time.
So, oh god, that was still XP back then. So imagine if Windows was following the same progression as MTGO, we'd still be rocking basically XP Service Pack like 4. That's
right. So the whole history of Magic Online and kind of where we started and how we ended up where we're at, it's like a whole podcast in of itself. And it's actually kind of kind of an interesting story in of itself. Like clearly like some things went good and some things didn't. And the things that didn't go very well, kind of had a very, I think the best way to put it is there are systemic issues that began with that first client that are only now really being rectified. That came with the most recent version of the client, kind of really undid the final kind of issues that started then.
I think a good metaphor that I've used before is that Magic Online was a rusty car, and instead of dealing with the rust, they painted over it, and then they painted over again, and then they painted over again, and eventually the side of the car just fell off, and they went, oh, shit, like, I guess that paint didn't fix the rust.
Oh, God, version 4.
And now they're literally being forced to, like, rebuild the car. And so you just have a ton of, you know, opinions being thrown around because people also feel like they're whatever they say right now can influence what happens since Magic Online is currently being worked on. So if I have a problem and I make that known, oh, that thing's going to be addressed and that thing's going to be fixed. Clearly that's not the case for every single little problem, but for large, you know, agreed upon, like, why can't we, or for example, a good one is right now when you go to close Magic Online, it asks you if you really want to log off of Magic Online. Like, it's a child-proofing for logging off of a client. Like, let's think about what the worst-case scenario is. The worst-case scenario is you absolutely log off, Magic Online saves everything, and you reload up in within 3 seconds, and you're back in. Like, that's the worst-case scenario that they're preventing against. And so people are like, I'm not a child. Let me close my client without having to click again. It just makes things frustrating. I can't close it via the task manager. Like, there's just all kinds of frustrating things. So, like, that was a huge thing maybe 6 months ago. People were just like, stop making me officially accept the closure of my client. That's a small thing that they might not have ever addressed because it doesn't just readily pop up as, like, this is something we need to fix. But there was enough people that complained about it that I would assume over time, eventually, that's going to be removed. I think it still exists right now, which is stupid, but yeah, like those little types of, you know, inputs and opinions do actually influence what they're gonna fix to a certain degree. So I understand why people are so quick to throw them out, but I also can understand being the person fixing Magic Online and constantly being bombarded by, you know, fix this, do this, this sucks, because like eventually you're like, I'm one dude, I'm trying to do my best here.
MTG Worth is just like, man, leave me alone.
Well, Worth gets a lot of shit, obviously. Worth does a very good job for the most part. I don't know exactly what his level of involvement is in pushing towards moving.
He's like the public face, though. So, I mean, it's just all
exactly. That's the thing. He's going to get
downhill.
He's going to get the credit, and he's going to get it's just the way it works.
And I also feel like they, unfortunately, when they came out with version 4, like you said, building a new car, it was just before the real kind of the advent and push of streaming, where obviously the new client has a lot of issues, it feels like, with pretty much every streaming program out there.
Well, that's true. Magic Online 3 saw plenty of streaming. Like, I would say that was kind of the rise of streaming was during 3, and people started to accept it. They were like, the graphics suck, the whatever suck, but at least it's usable. But yeah, version 4 is both, I mean, the graphics have not improved very much. I would say the layout overall for getting people that don't understand the game to kind of follow along is better, like having the phases.
It's more customizable, too, a little bit.
Yeah, like there are some things that have definitely improved. But
It's actually not more customizable. Like that's also like talk about like the bucket list of things people complain about. So in version 3, you could basically put like any custom background you want. Like effectively, like imagine like, you know, when you sit down and like you play a game of Magic, you can put down like a playmat. And it's like whatever you want on that playmat. That's kind of how version 3 was, where they could show whatever you wanted in the play area. That's not something that you can do in version 4. And so people are like, you know, they still complain about that. Because obviously it's very helpful for like streaming or videos because you can just put your logo or your branding right into the client. You don't have to worry about creating an overlay or anything like that. It was a very clever, easy solution, and almost anybody could do that. You just swapped out some files in the folder. But obviously, you know, for example, if you're a game company, do you really want anybody to be able to put whatever logo or branding they want inside of your own client?
I would guess no.
There's a ton of problems with that. I'm trying to remember the name of the game, but like, so all they did in this one free-to-play game, right, is they say, okay, for money, you can pay to put like flags and just use the flags of countries involved in World War II on your flag, on your plane or your tank. Like that's all it was just literally add the flags and where to place it. So obviously immediately people are like putting swastika shaped flags and like making like obscene things. And it's just like any way that you have of creating like a personalized thing creates these systemic issues down the road. And so while changing lots the client on your side didn't actually affect the opponent, like basically you could use Magic Online to contain whatever branding or logo you wanted. And I don't think any company that makes a game wants players to be able to put their own logos and branding inside of the game quite like that.
I guess for my side of customizable, I feel like there's still some more customizable options for how I can lay out my user interface, maybe more the UI, not necessarily the play feel background. Except for that window that highlights cards is mysterious to me.
That's fair. I was mostly talking about like the actual, just the way that they've laid out phases, the way that your hand is, the graveyard and stuff like that. Like as long as you know where to click, clicking on a graveyard now instantly moves like the little bar over so you can see the whole graveyard as opposed to having to drag it out under the playmat and then make it bigger and stuff like that. Like I just think those little things have made streaming a little bit easier. But overall, the fact that I have to do full screen mode, I can't do windowed mode because it just doesn't capture it as a window, and I have to have my entire computer.
Yeah, the desktop capture, basically.
Yeah, exactly, which is just not very friendly when it comes to streaming, because at that point, if I have one monitor, I can't look at any other content without other people being able to see it, et cetera, or I have to have my screenshot minimized. In addition to things like the audio being weird, the client being extremely laggy. If you're streaming, you have to reset your stream about once an hour. Otherwise, it just gets too far behind to where there's a 6-second delay. But like you're literally talking, and it'll just like 6-second delay 100% of the time. So there's just a lot of things that aren't friendly when it comes to the mechanics. But that's a really shitty thing because of how popular streaming is right now, and because how many people want to stream Magic Online. Magic could theoretically be blowing up much bigger than it is right now, just because people are like, "Hey, Magic is fourth on the Twitch most viewed thing. What is this game? Let me go check it out." Okay, there's 2,500 people in this room talking about this game. Like, I'm just going to pick up a couple bits and pieces. I'm going to watch it for a few minutes, maybe tune it because I'm just interested. But it plants a seed, and that gets, you know, potentially more people playing Magic, more people viewing Magic, and it also gets more people specifically involved in the Twitch community, which I think Magic could use a lot more backing in, just the general idea of streaming. We really only have a handful of consistent streamers, and then we have, like, a bunch of people who stream to their friends and kind of do it as like an afternoon thing, like an activity, but aren't necessarily like, you know, here's my hours, I'm showing up for duty, like streaming like it's my job. When if you look at a game like League of Legends, there are hundreds of players that are able to actually stream on a pretty regular basis and receive tips and viewers and stuff like that. And of course that community is much larger, but it's still something that Magic could be working towards. And part of the reason we can't get there yet is because the technology just doesn't exist with our game.
Do you feel like that's a little bit – is that what they view it's a kind of a different news item, but the whole Magic Origins or the kind of the rebirth of the Duels of the Planeswalkers project is going to be free to play. It's going to be on a bunch of different, you know, Xbox, PS4, everything. Do you feel like that's going to maybe be where they want the streaming content to come from?
No, I mean, that stuff's awesome, but that's not Magic. It's Magic to a certain degree, but it's still not like their flagship is a game with certain rules, with certain – dynamics and with certain boundaries, and all of those games that capture a portion of it are nice. They do a specific thing. Maybe they get players involved. Maybe they get players interested, whatever, but they're not the game. Like, Duels of the Planeswalkers is an awesome product, but if I told my friend, hey, do you want to play Magic on Friday, never once would he go, oh, you mean Duels of the Planeswalkers? That's not Magic. When I say we want to play Magic, we're going to FNM, we're playing in a tournament, we're sitting down playing Commander, but we're not, like, restricting ourselves to 5% of the total card pool of a game that we love because it's so vast and customizable and whatnot. like duels with planeswalkers, like I said, it's awesome. It's great to have around. It is a very important thing for a new age environment, but it is a stepping stone to the game. So if you're trying to capture only that, I think you're missing out on the vastness that is Magic. And like, sure, that is a daunting thing. You should not expose players to the vastness that is Magic right away. But eventually, like, that's where everyone else is. Like if everyone's swimming in the deep end of the pool and you're the only person over in the shallow in the pool, it's cool, you need to learn how to swim for a while. But eventually, come have fun with us. We're not going to all go sit in the 3-foot pool with you just because you don't know how to swim.
I will. Don't worry about that.
I'm just literally just coming up with analogies.
That's just kind of hitting off of what Conley said, like talk about like Magic Online versus like Duels of the Planeswalkers or Magic Origins. Magic Duels Origins is like the subtitle, I guess, for the new upcoming version. So what's one of the things that Magic players complain about all the time? How much the game costs.
Everything. Okay.
Everything, but like primarily one of the things is like everything costs money and like the game's expensive and they're always coming out with new products because they're a retail-based organization and they want to constantly sell new stuff and I don't understand how that works. You know, selling new stuff to make money.
Sell more stuff.
So like if you're trying to explain the game to a new player, right, like the game is obviously very compelling. There's a lot of really rich strategy involved with it. The fantasy is great. The art is great. The flavor is great. The mechanics generally feel pretty good these days. There isn't, like, trying to explain somebody suspend and how that works versus raid, opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of, like, relatability.
No, you take it for somebody who's here.
Somebody who has no idea what's going on with the game. Raid's like, oh, cool, I get this bonus when I do this thing that I want to do anyway. Great. That's a little bit of a hyperbole in there, but, like, that's just kind of where we've come from in the past, you know, decade or so of Magic. The thing that free to play brings, and it's what's made Duels of the Planeswalkers and stuff so great, is you have this nominal investment for a great game, and nobody's going to argue playing Magic isn't awesome. Like Magic is a great game, and so like when you pay $10, right, or you spend a couple dozen hours, you know, or even just half of that, playing Magic on a digital client, and you're new to the game, like it feels good. Like the people that are going to get into Magic get hooked that way. So what free-to-play brings to the mix is a way to introduce players to it, not overwhelm them with this entire vast array of Magic, because Magic's really freaking huge and complex, but also allow them to play and feel like they're getting something for their time, getting something for their effort, where if they spend a couple bucks and they put this extra stuff into it, you know, they get to have fun. And I think that's what's helped Magic grow so much over the past couple of years, at least how I've felt about it, you know, going to pre-releases and stuff. Like, it's all very integrated. Like, cool, I'm playing this digital thing, but it's telling me to go to my local store. Wonder why that is. That's all.
Good points.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, actually good points. I'm being with
you. Yeah. Kindly, I went back to third grade.
I couldn't tell if you were listening or not.
We went back to third grade for about...
I was just doing this innocently, and then Tom decided that I was doing it somehow to be malicious and decided he had to one-up me for no reason. And then I couldn't let that be, so I have to go a little bit bigger.
I am still 50-50 on whether adding video is, like, a good thing or a bad thing. It's just, like, we already had trouble with, like, tangents and segues and Tom being Tom and awesome and all of that. And now it's, like, you've got really the visual dimension. Like I'm waiting for Tom to, like, start wearing costumes or masks or, like, props or, like... So like wear like a nude like nu- like a nude
the closet.
Suit from the waist down, so he just stands up and bends over, and like you don't know if he's naked or not.
The next
that way, like
the next cast, I'm literally just gonna have the Harlem Shake happen in the background, like the classic. Right. You know.
He's gonna have like his cat sit with the headphones. He's just gonna like talk off screen, like
where did Tom go?
He just went to like I don't know mess with us somehow. Like this is what Tom does. So.
It's a pirate eye patch, but for a little girl, so it has a feather on it. We had a pirate party.
I don't understand why it has a feather.
I don't know.
The only feather thing on a pirate I've ever heard of is a parrot on the shoulder.
Yeah, well, it also has sparklies on it, too, so.
All right, good enough.
The fake mustaches were a little farther back in there, but I do have a whole pile of
mustaches. I'm just going to apply this deodorant.
If we haven't mentioned it, I really would recommend you watch the video now for our new podcast, because I am wearing an eye patch. Fortunately, if you get Adam, I should say, as a having a children, have you gone to the Oriental Trading website where you can buy just like 12 of every like party favor toy you can ever imagine?
What are you talking? What?
That's like a well-known. The name sounds quasi-racist. I will just do that.
It's a real site. I've never gone there, but that's where my wife picked up our favors for our upcoming daughter's birthday party.
In my world,
party, I'm aware it exists and is a thing.
It is called Oriental Trace. So I agree. It sounds really weird.
No, I picked up some party favors the other day too.
Okay, this thing hurts. I'm taking it off, but it's stuck under my.
You put your headphones on after you put that thing on. So you
have to... we could all live through that with you.
What's our second topic? I don't even know.
We've hit three. So
yeah, we can hit the big ones. The only one I want to, this would be a very quick one, and we could probably wrap it up. Is do either of you guys, Adam Conley, do you guys care much about Judge promos? It seems like everybody got really excited about the most recent.
Honest with you. I used to care more about Judge promos before the way they changed the way they give them out. Now I don't exactly understand how it works, and so I'm not as excited. Because I'm pretty sure, the way they handle judge compensation has changed over the last couple of years, and I don't know exactly how it happens anymore. But I've heard a lot of my judge friends complain about it, and so I've lost interest in exactly the process. I'm sure Adam knows better.
Actually, I literally don't know. Like, is it a certain
level? Basically, they switched it from basically judges who worked Grand Prix and Pro Tours would just automatically get judge foils, some judge packet, right? And typically that packet would either go to the judge's trade binder or get flipped to a dealer for typically sealed, contained for some set amount. That was kind of the general way a lot of judges handled. So it was perceived as a form of compensation, rightly or wrongly. Like, I don't know exactly how that side of it worked, but it was just that's something Wizards did. So they changed it, and the way judge foils work now is through the Exemplar program. And basically, the Exemplar program is designed to be, and this is all from like what they've laid out. I'm not a judge, obviously, so I'm just going from my understanding from all the public announcements about it. But basically, recognition based, where judges recommend other judges. And in theory, through the network of regional coordinators, high-level judges, all the way down to L2s at the local level that are running all the preliminary PTQs worldwide, judges get recognized and are mailed out foils. So it's kind of like a heavily modified version of the old Players Rewards program, where like you would get stuff in the mail, but it's cool, all kind of this nebulous recognition-based. So right there, that people nominate and recommend already makes people go wild because it's just, it's nebulous. It's no longer a checklist or a guarantee of anything. It's just, did I do a job awesome enough that enough people talked about me that maybe I get something. So there's a lot of uneasiness about that, and it's obviously a new process. I can't speak to how well it's working or not working, but that's kind of how the new process is. And the downside is that compensation has kind of shifted, I think rightly, wholly on tournament organizers, where if you're bringing in staff, you are now responsible for taking care of that staff through compensation. That's kind of my understanding, is that there's no longer this free roll thing that's coming from Wizards or from other source other than the TO themselves to provide.
I agree with that, but most of my judge friends, what they've complained about is that the compensation is generally being paid out now in booster packs. So a lot, like, you'll get like 3 to 4 booster boxes for working like a large Grand Prix or something. And the problem is let's say you work during a specific set, let's say you work 6 to 7 Grand Prix, which is not that unreasonable over the course of a 3-month span, you accumulate so many booster boxes and that over time their value naturally drops anyway, that you basically have a very hard time turning those things for profit. So you have to either like open the packs individually and hope to get lucky on your singles or want the cards. Otherwise, you tend to get significantly less money than you were with the foils, which had like a set amount and they were always extremely high when they first came out. Now you're getting basically a commodity that everybody has access to. So the thing you're getting is not special anymore, and it's very difficult to turn. I've seen people like literally carting around cases of booster boxes, judges, like trying to pawn them off after a event, just because they need to pay for their hotel or they need to pay for a plane ticket or something like that. And I could see it being extremely difficult, which is, I think they made a move towards like getting local judges significantly more and things of that nature. But maybe that's just going to be a mentality shift in the organizers that'll change over time. They'll start paying cash reimbursements or something. I don't know what they're going to do, but I do think that paying out booster packs is a little lame, but we'll see.
Yeah. And I'm not in any way saying that how judges are being compensated or feel they're being compensated is appropriate or inappropriate. Like, that's definitely a different discussion, and I don't have as much room to talk about that. You know, I do feel strongly that tournament organizers have a responsibility to take care of their staff, which includes the judges that allow their event to run. And that's just how I feel about it. It'd be like, you know, it's the reason that if you volunteer, you know, for like an event like PAX as like an enforcer, your badge gets covered and you get some other benefits and perks with that. That's just part of the deal. Like,
is that
you
like
just
a
don't
bouncer?
You don't have that's to buy your own badge to go and then work at PAX. Like, that's just not how conventions work. But the kind of the big upside, theoretically, of the new exemplar program is judges in like countries like, you know, Malta, right? Malta is now a representative of the World Magic Cup. You know, how many judges from Malta get to go to a Grand Prix in a year? Or how many even players from Malta get to go to a Grand Prix in a year? You know, that the places where judges were, like South America is another great example, these locations where it's difficult for those judges to go to large events, or they don't have opportunities, or the events are small, so like when there is one, it's difficult to bring in, you know, more local judges that you would want necessarily, because they're just, there isn't a need for them from an organization standpoint. The exemplar program is to help basically spread that out. Yeah, that's kind of my understanding of it, looking from the outside, is that it's no longer based on, are you a judge that can grind the Grand Prix circuit? Great, you get all these foils. If you're not, well, too bad. I guess maybe you need to make the judges happy and get on the Grand Prix circuit. Now it's totally based on, are you doing a great job for your, theoretically, are you doing a great job for your local stores and community? Are you helping advance the judge program? Are you being the type of contributor that's worthy of the type of recognition that bonuses like foils, and that's what they're being treated as now, is just a bonus, not as a part of what you get as a judge or part of what you get as a, you know, attendee or a judge at a Grand Prix. It's just an extra thing now. You know, kind of the, That's the program now, Tom.
Okay.
By the way, little known fact, Malta is number one export, Malta meal.
They had to go there. They had to go there.
I'm
saying like Croatia is like cream of wheat or something.
Not true. I feel like that can't be true.
I will step out of limb without knowing either way. I'll guarantee that that's not true. It's more likely to be modular furniture.
You said you were excited for the foils, that you were kind of delighted or excited. Like what? Why?
It made me go look at the reserved list because they have announced five different judge promos. We have Damnation. We have Dual Caster Mage, Felden of the Third Path, Ravages of War, which for me is just being a more casual path.
That's the best one. It was like $1 million.
Yeah, it would be really cool. And then Wasteland, which is one that made me go, is that not on the reserved list? And no, it's not.
Because it's uncommon.
It's not
if we need more of them, because that card has gotten way too expensive.
Yeah, that just in my mind, it was
Wasteland,
like,
was an FNM promo, and it's already been a judge promo. So this is like its second, this is like its third time down the promo lane.
Well, but every time I see it, it's like, really?
Wizard's way of saying we're not getting this card in any sort of reasonable reprint anytime soon.
But, I mean, honestly, one of the things that scares me most about...
Uh-oh. Conley had warned me his internet might die at some point. And it may have just died right now.
So we have no idea what Conley is most concerned about. I think he's most concerned about a lack of Arby's. That Arby's is a criminally underrated food chain nationwide, and I think he's genuinely concerned that there isn't enough Arby's in the world. And I'm inclined to agree. However, I'm kind of being a little observant about what I eat these days, so I'm not willing to jump on that bandwagon. I think there's enough Arby's, at least for me, but maybe not for Conley.
See, I think he might not be angry necessarily about the access or total amount of Arby's. It might be more the access to the beef brisket sandwich, because that was a pretty amazing sandwich. Kyle, we were just talking that you were pretty concerned about the about Arby's.
Why am I concerned about Arby's?
We were just, because you cut off right when you were about to say you're concerned about. We theorized it had to be about Arby's.
Yeah.
Oh, my bad. I'm concerned about Eternal formats, just because of card availability and specifically the reserve list and whatnot. Basically, these formats just don't get the, like, Legacy, it has essentially gotten love almost exclusively from Star City Games over the last couple of years. They get a couple of Grand Prix a year, but that's not really enough to kind of keep the format going. And Vintage is outside of, like, the Vintage Super League, which is a Magic Online thing. Like, it feels like Eternal formats are moving slowly towards an online-only space, which is a little sad just because seeing a Mox in person or seeing somebody cast a Time Walk in person or whatever is like, although it's kind of a surreal moment, it's also very just epic, and you just feel like you're part of something old and historic, and it just feels kind of cool. I don't know. It's really hard to explain, but being at a vintage tournament is definitely different than any other tournament environment I've ever been at, and it kind of sucks to see those formats lose support, lose card availability, see their prices of those cards skyrocket. Like, a playset of Underground Seas these days is just absurd if you want to play any of those formats. Even if you're just getting revised ones, they're still very, very expensive. And it kind of worries me a little bit because you really don't want to see, like, Magic's past forgotten, sort of. But we're moving far enough away from it now that I think it's becoming more and more of a realistic thing. And I don't know. It's a little bit of a bummer for me.
I was pulling up Underground Sea Revised as I, off the top of my head, I'm not sure what they're going for. Oh, good God.
What do you see, Tom?
Jesus, I went to mdgprice.com. That's just tend where I go if I want to see a price really fast. From Strike Zone, so again, I'm not looking at all the places available, but we're looking usually between, we'll say roughly $275 to $300 a piece.
For a single, yeah. So if you want four of those to play your normal blue-black anything deck, because that's the way Vintage and Legacy is, you are spending over $1,000 for four of a land. And if you go to alpha or beta versions of that, you're talking about $1,000 a piece, $1,200 a piece. Like, it gets absurd.
Yeah, let's see. So should I go to beta? I mean, usually beta is the most valuable.
Yeah, beta and alpha, Underground Seas are both worth more than most of power, the pieces of power. Because you need four of them, so they're just more valuable.
Oh, I guess I never thought of it that way exactly. That.
Yeah. You need exactly one Mox Sapphire, if you're playing a blue-black deck.
You need just a boatload of stuff. I'm like, okay, there's apparently, I don't know, I'm not sure how many are available. According to this, there are some places selling these for as much as like a couple of $1,000.
Yeah, no. I mean, if they're good condition, like, that's not completely unreasonable. If you've held on to your Beta Underground Seas 3 years ago were like a couple $100. So like, if you've just held on to them for the last couple of years, they've inflated faster than almost any company that exists on the Fortune 500 list. Like the stats that have been done for the vintage market are incredible in terms of like investment. But the thing is, eventually that bubble is going to break. Eventually, when Underground Sea is worth $10,000, nobody's going to want to play vintage anymore because you simply can't get into it. And then it becomes an online only format. And I think it's cool that there's some way to preserve it, but I would like them to see, you know, like eventually who wins when vintage is no longer a format, legacy of longer down the road, of course, but eventually legacy is not a format simply because card availability. Like, are the people sitting at home who are really chanted for the reserve list to stick around? Are they happy? Did they win? Like, they have these cards that potentially aren't even worth anything anymore because nobody plays their formats, or they're worth something only on collectability alone. Like, I think that prioritizing the reserve list for collectors is generally a bad move, even if it like seems like a good business decision. It just feels like the wrong move to me, and I hope that it doesn't catch up to us too soon and kind of bite us in the butt.
So my counterpoint to that is the collectability promise, the fact that they limited it to such a narrow set of Magic that's virtually, you know, nobody that plays Magic, like, I would say the percentage of people that are playing Magic today that were available and willing to play the game when Underground Sea was printed in any of its forms is so small, it's ridiculous. Like, Magic is built to be, to move forward. Like, you know, I barely remember the days when, like, a dual land was a thing. Like, I remember, like, you know, the 4th edition Soul Ring or Limited Soul Ring or whatever it was, and, like, I remember it was like, oh, that's a really powerful card, and, like, somebody had in one of their decks, and it was neat to see, and it was a cool thing to talk about, but, like, it was never, like, really what defined Magic for me. That the fact that Tarmogoyf was reprinted and went up at value means that the value cards are still always tied to the people that want to play them. The difference, though, is with Tarmogoyf, like, if Magic dies, right? Wizards could just literally print, like, a cube set. Like, hey, we need to sell cards. Let's just print a cube of, like, the best stuff in Modern and just, like, sell it as, like, a box set, right? And people would buy that because, like, they still want to get these cards at some point. But the fact that you can never reprint something that is actually collectible means it still retains value. So the players that have always wanted to complete a beta set or want to have their dark set, like the guy that I ran into at Friday Night Magic just last Friday, you know, he was still looking for a Blood Moon from the Dark because that was the last one he needed to complete his set. Like, the fact that those cards are actually still collectible makes them different from the cards that we're using today.
And that's true, but him needing a Dark Blood Moon doesn't change if they reprint Blood Moon as, you know, X or whatever. Like, somebody wanting their Alpha, like, Alpha Lotus is still going to be an Alpha Lotus if there's Foil Lotus of Wrath or whatever in the new set. Like, in that world, of course, that would be a different card type and you'd be able to run both in Vintage or whatever. But, like, even if they did that, even if they said ban power, power's banned from Vintage, let's reprint, functionally reprint power with different names or whatever and have a new format, you keep your power, you collect the hell out of that, you let it sit in your closet, nobody will ever touch a piece of power again. Instead, we're going to have these functional reprints of pieces of power with new names and sparkly art, and then we're going to revive Vintage with these cards legal only there, and we're going to keep the functionality of this awesome format that literally covers all Magic cards ever existing, which is a cool concept just to have, like that idea of, like, Magic is old and rich and vast, and let's embrace that. Just the fact that gameplay is missing. I don't care so much about the cards. Like, I want people to experience that gameplay because it's so different. Like, that was how I got started into the Tournament Magic, was playing Vintage, and it was just such a different feel. The community was amazing. There's so much more social. You know, after you would finish the tournament, everybody, like 10 to 12 people, would just go out and have a beer and drink and eat and stuff. It was just like one of the, like, I can't imagine actually getting into Tournament Magic in a different way. Like, I think if I'd come up in the PTQ scene, I would have just been bitter and hated people and, like, dropped out. But I actually had a really good group of support from this Vintage community who was willing to let me borrow cards or talk about my deck or work on it. I chatted with people on Mana Drain and stuff like that, and it was just like some of the best times of my life. And unfortunately, as I moved into more of a professional setting, Vintage is just not something you can really do when you're a professional because there's no reason to do it. You're just doing it for fun, really. I mean, the Vintage Super League is kind of the one new exception. That's a brand new thing, and it takes care of 8 people or whatever. But when it comes to, like, Tournament Magic, there are no Vintage tournaments. And missing out on that gameplay is something I've kind of, like, longed for years. It's something I would love to be able to kind of get back into and play a little bit, but I simply don't have the time, and there's no way to do it competitively. So it's kind of just something that, you know, maybe I get to watch Luis play a match of Vintage Super League, and that's my kind of Vintage experience. But I would love it if, like, that experience was something more accessible to people, regardless of whether, you know, Mock Sapphire should be a $10,000 card or a $10 card. Like, I would like people just to be able to play with a Mock Sapphire. And I, like I said, Magic Online gets there to a certain degree, but Magic Online has so many flaws in it right now that I think pointing anyone to go, well, there's Magic Online, like, I think that's just a bad argument right now. So it's just kind of a frustrating feeling to watch these formats kind of slowly wither away. I think Legacy's doing it as well at a slower pace just because it doesn't have these super, super iconic cards. But I think that if Star City wasn't still doing Legacy, I think Legacy would be already dead. And while Star City's doing Legacy, it's kind of like keeping it alive on the breathing apparatus right now is what it feels like. Like, as soon as they stop support, I can't imagine more than 1 or 2 Grand Prix a year, Legacy cards just become an obsolete thing. They're already not supporting at the Pro Tour they used to back in the day, but they stopped that. So I don't know. It's like I said, it's just more of a sad realization than anything. I don't know if there's, like, a direct thing they can do with it, but it's also not something I don't know if they're even looking to address. So
yeah, and I just feel the fact that what makes Vintage and Legacy feel so special, what brings those people that genuinely care about the formats, that those guys that you talk to that are super nice and are like, yeah, I want you to play, and here's some cards, you know, like you're an awesome guy, I'm going to let you have these cards, and let's play in this tournament this weekend, or this local store that's running it special for us, and, like, that community aspect of it, I think, is driven in part because of that exclusivity. Right, I really feel that if you just, you know, make these functional reprints of cards, like, okay, well, we're not reprinting Black Lotus, but we're going to have White Lotus that does the exact same thing, and you can use it in this, like, nouveau Vintage format. It's not Vintage, but it's, like, Vintage Plus, and it's, like, with this different set. And by the way, what you can use in Vintage is banned, so you got to use this other stuff instead. It's like that fracturing, I mean, it's gonna create some fracturing. It's going to create some dissonance. And I think it takes away from what makes Vintage so interesting and appealing and attractive. Like, that exclusivity is part of it. Like
I don't know if I can get behind that.
Take that away, and, like, it's actually it's an okay format, but it's still just okay. You know, it's not that compelling in of itself.
I don't know if I could fully get behind that argument, just because when I was coming into the vintage tournament, it was basically 100% proxy tournaments. Like, you would use 15 proxies every time, and
yeah, I mean, that was a huge thing in the U.S. back in the day, just as a disclaimer at the bottom.
Yeah, and then, like, one of my favorites, like, I used to actually do my own card alters. I still have some lying around just for a piece of power that I would, like, take, like, basic swamps or whatever that said tap for black. I would, like, change the art. I would draw a mox on it. It, like, looked pretty sweet. Like, and people did it all the time. They did, like, their own card alters. That was kind of actually kind of where, like, card alters started, was vintage. But, yeah, it was just a cool thing to do. And everyone acknowledged that, hey, these cards are so expensive that we cannot justify this 16-year-old kid. Like, he does not have access to the $5,000 at the time to buy a set of Power 9. Like, that's not fair to him that he doesn't get to experience this format with us. So let's make 15 proxies a thing. Oh, WotC doesn't want to support 15 proxies. I can sort of understand that, sure. So we have to make all vintage tournaments with proxies unsanctioned, which was true. So you had this entire underground community where we were playing vintage tournaments all the time, and you would never see our ratings change. You would go online to, like, your DCI ratings, and your eternal rating would just never change, even though you were playing tournaments every single weekend. And it was kind of this weird thing where it's like, you know, we're having to do this thing that we love, this thing that this awesome experience that we all want to have, and we're being kind of held back due to financial restrictions, and Magic's already an expensive game that we've already committed to traveling for and doing whatnot and spending all this money on, and we just can't come up with these, you know, huge amounts of money at this point to actually invest in a real vintage deck. And also, for what it's worth, the design of White Lotus, you ban all, ban Black Lotus is probably dead. It would probably be like White Lotus says, you cannot include me in a deck with Black Lotus or something, so like you could use one or the other. Like, I think you would still let people use their original power if they wanted to. Then again, that was just spitballing an idea. But I would just, like I said, I would just love to see the idea of Vintage and Legacy supported a little bit more. You know, if it becomes a Magic Online only thing, I'm fine with that if Magic Online steps up its game. But as long as Magic Online is just a POS, like, it sucks to have one of your favorite things, like, represented in such a poor light.
Yeah, so like, I just still have a hard time imagining, like, those proxy tournaments. So, like, that was probably, what, like, 8 years ago? Spitballing. So, like, 8 years ago, like, Underground Sea was, like, $80 or 70 bucks, something like that. So, you deflate all of the card prices already. Then the 15 most expensive cards that you can't afford or you can't find, you know, were effectively free. So, like, right there, I just have a hard time thinking, like, okay, so let's say half these cards are costing four times what they cost before. Oh, and now all of these 15 cards that, like, people used to proxy are now, like, also in that range. Like, I just don't feel like it's effectively solving the...
Oh, like, sure,
The accessibility problem, like, you're kind of pointing at. Like, reprinting it doesn't actually make the format accessible, per se.
That's fair. 15 cards would certainly not do it if you had unlimited proxies. Like, the reason people do 15 proxies is that way you would have some encouragement to still buy stuff from the shop you showed up to. Like, they would have their Wastelands and their Dual Lands. They would want to sell you something. So they'd be like, yeah, you can. We understand you can't afford these Moxes and stuff like that, but the Flooded Strands you want for your deck, we're going to ask you to throw down $50 to buy those or whatever. But, you know, theoretically, an unlimited proxy format might be able to get there. I haven't thought of all the specifics as Tom talks to somebody. I haven't thought about all the specifics, obviously. But, like I said, it's more just, like, how I feel about it more than, like, actually coming up with a plan to solve it. It just is one of those things where it's, like, something that you used to love that, like, you just have grown apart from, and you've also seen very few other people kind of take care of it. That just kind of is, like, a weird feeling. The Vintage Super League does give me hope, though, because people are actually watching that, and it's picked up kind of attention and stuff like that. And if Vintage is getting into the average person, average Magic player's kind of rhetoric and into their thoughts or whatever, then maybe all of a sudden you foster a love for the format by showing people how cool it could be. So the Vintage Super League could very easily save Vintage. I would hope it does. But we'll see over time. Like, that's a long-term process.
Yeah, the one thing that I would really like to see is, so, like, right now, like, in the States, we have Eternal Weekend. So, like, Legacy and Vintage have, like, a, like, kind of like a de facto championship of sorts. Like, it's open. There's no qualification for it. But, like, anybody can play up. You have to have completely legit decks, you know, 100%, and you play, and you can be a champion. You get, like, a basically a special,
you know, alternate art version, of, oversized version of a card with, like, the art and stuff like that. It's kind of a cool thing. I would really like to see them expand that, right? Because it's, like, Eternal's not just played in the States. In fact, like actual vintage was, like, a bigger deal in Europe, where they never had proxy tournaments. Like, that was never a thing that took off. Like, people played with their actual cards. And I'd really like to see, like, that kind of go global, where, like, you have, like an APAC Eternal Weekend, a U.S. or North America Eternal Weekend, like a European Eternal Weekend. And maybe it's all at the same time, so, like, nobody can, like, jet set around the world and try to, like, have three shots for a championship, quote-unquote. But, like, expand support by bringing it, like, a global focus instead of just a U.S. side. So, like I agree with you, there are things that could be done, like, today that could help expand the, you know, the kind of the focus on vintage and legacy.
Yeah, it is kind of sad. Was it? I'm in the vast minority, but I was playing way back when we got those cards out of packs, and that was the way it went. But yeah, it sucks. I recently sold all my power cards to buy a playground set, so it showed that the crazy value some of these cards have. Totally worth it for an enormous, awesome playground set. But it is crazy that you can literally exchange a handful of cards right now. As Kylie mentioned, if you're looking from 3 years ago till now, where I still remember I'd opened out of packs most of the power cards, but for me, a Black Lotus is something I actually never got out of a pack. It was, for some reason, there was only a few people that had one, so eventually I decided I was going to buy one. So for the kids that were around before the internet, if you wanted to buy something you didn't have eBay, you had the classified section in the back of the newspaper. So way back there, you could find the miscellaneous sports card area, and once in a while there'd be a Magic card listing, and I met a random, probably somewhat scary man in a McDonald's to buy some cards. At that point, I was spending, you know, people are going to be mad because I wish I would have bought more. I spent $30 for Black Lotus, and that seemed like a crazy amount of money at that point to spend on one card. So that could buy you like 20 packs. For you, Em, do you have anything from like way back in the day where you, and you know, at that point at income levels, you felt like you were spending a crazy amount of money, but now in retrospect, you're like, I should have mugged this man and taken every card that he had.
I was, you know, I'm not as old as like the actual long time Magic players. Like people that have been playing Magic since the beginning were typically like, you know, late teens, early 20s when Magic started. So like they're hitting like mid 40s these days, early 50s. Like that's kind of the age bracket that at least I perceive. Like I remember I was like just in early high school and I was playing like Tempest and Urza Saga. Like Magic was just a little bit before my time, so, like, I couldn't go out and just, like, buy every reserve pack I could find and sit on them, you know, for a decade or anything like that. Not that I would have, like, I had no discipline anyway. But what I did do is, almost 3 years ago now, I worked on getting a foreign black-bordered version of one of each of the dual lands, because I wanted a black-bordered duel for my commander decks. And I only have one copy of each duel, and I don't fill my decks with dual lands. I just choose which one is the most needs the mana fixing the most, and I put it in there. And so what I did was I completed that set. The last card that I got was I got a black-bordered Italian, I believe, Tundra, and I traded a whole bunch of stuff at Standard for it. And that's what that was the last thing I did. So one of the things I checked on is I had a signed Italian, really great condition, like looks near mint, except it's signed by Rob Alexander, Underground Sea in Italian. And I picked it up at Gen Con, and it was like mid-200s, and now it's effectively doubled, even with the signature on it. Like, it just doubled up because it's a black-bordered dual land. That's the only kind of stuff that I have now. And it's like, oftentimes if I'm taking my commander deck to, like, an event or, when I went to PAX, I seriously considered taking a lot of that stuff out and just playing, you know, just an inferior land or just a basic land instead, because I just didn't want to deal with the hassle of, hey, if it gets lifted, like, I could replace my full Farika very easily. I cannot replace my black-bordered French Savannah, so. Mm. Or it was not Savannah, Bayou.
All right.
But, yeah, I never had anything from those days.
Yeah, I made a lot of friends that have, like, a box of revised saved away for some odd reason. I think because we were playing sort of, like, forms of limited at that point, so everybody would often have a booster box just for those special events. But, guys, we are pretty coming up to I'm old. I need to go to bed because I get tired at, like, 10 p.m.
I slept. How old are you, like, 43?
What's that? Do you actually want to hold that?
No, I know how old you are.
Oh, okay.
You feel free to tell everyone watching.
Yeah, inside I felt 55 today. That was an exact quote on my mouth. Because the quote, a couple of good quotes today. One was Amelia told me my hair looked like a girl's, so I thought that was great. So I got a haircut today. And then number two is she did tell me that my boobies look like her boobies. So I thought that was a good one.
Tom, you're going to get our entire cast just raided by the police.
Adam has a 3 to 4 year old girl. They are odd at that age. Adam's ignoring me. So I'm glad for that.
Adam's kid's not odd at all. It's perfect. She's great.
She'll go very normally, which is good.
She's perfectly normal. Your kid is strange because you are strange.
Yeah, mermaid bears. That is the current obsession.
There you go. So, no one else in the world knows what a mermaid bear is except for you.
I still don't know what it is. Like, is the bear the front half? Is the bear the back half? She hasn't explained it to me. And what does a mermaid bear eat?
You should sit down and have this conversation with her.
We've tried it. I asked her to draw it.
And then she didn't do it.
Rough. So, guys, how about we share our emails where people can find us, what articles you write, and we'll wrap it up because I need to eat my usual post-podcast bowl of Golden Grahams. Best cereal ever. Ever.
You're talking, Tom.
All right, Conley.
What? I just said you go first, and then you assigned it to me.
Oh, me? Okay, sure. Because I don't have much, that's why. So I guess I can get mine out of the way.
So just go with it.
Yeah. Email to me, email the show at mtgpopery@gatheringmagic.com. Because, Adam, we are very appreciative of Gathering Magic posting everything and doing all the work. Or if you do like to use Twitter, I am at PSGReader. Conley.
All right. So I'm also on Twitter at Conley81. Also write articles for tcgplayer.com, channelfireball.com, video content for channelfireball.com. I just did my set review for TCG Player, so if you're interested in any of that knowledge, feel free to go check that out. I believe they will have something at the top of the page that like has all five colors and everything.
You just had your last one go up, I think, what, a day ago? I don't remember.
On Friday, yeah. No. Yeah. It was one every day, all week, last week. No email. That's about it. Oh, I'm going to GP Vegas. So if you're going to GP Vegas, feel free to say hi. I'll be there all week long. There's three bounty events starting Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday that Channel Fireball Pros will be playing in. So if you're interested in joining any of those things, look into that. Change your travel schedule to potentially head out a day early or 2 days early. Vegas is not exactly a bad destination to do that anyway. So.
Yeah, because you can always get the prostitute cards used as tokens.
Yeah, so
there you go.
That's exactly why it's better.
And I'm Adam Sporsky. You can find me on Twitter at @B_Stibs, STYBS. I'm on Twitter generally all the time, so you can annoy me at all hours of the day and night, and I'll probably respond to you not so long after that. You can find me on Gathering Magic as the content manager, stibs@gatheringmagic.com, so you can yell at me, rail at me, remind me to read something that I didn't read from you, sure. You can also find me on dailymtg.com, that's magicthegathering.com, official website, all the articles. Mm-hmm. I write the Thursday column, Command Tower, which is why I said so much about Commander and the format. And called a whole bunch of people a bunch of things recently. Yeah, that's how you can find me.
Details, damn it.
All right. Also, before we go, quick shout out/moment of silence for Magic Gathering copy editor Mike McCarter. We weren't able to be on air or anything when that happened, so it's a little bit after the fact. But I worked with him when I did Daily Decks. Great guy. I didn't really work with him in person, but obviously a tragic loss to the community as a whole and to Wizards of the Coast. So.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I don't know. Like, there's not a good place to bring that up. Or obviously, want to have the memories. You know, share that. But it's just not a great. It's just never a good time.
Yeah.
And I know Adam. Obviously, you knew him by far the best of any of us.
I really wish we hadn't brought it up.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's been unpleasant today. We're recording, and there's a memorial in Seattle, and I couldn't be there for it, and I really felt like I should have. It's been unpleasant. So,
My apologies.
He's really, really awesome. No, he's a really, really awesome guy. And, you know, I think I did what I could to kind of capture how he was and what it was like to work with him in kind of my piece of the memorial article that went up last week on Daily MTG. So you can look that up and kind of see a whole bunch of great thoughts about it. He's a really great guy, so he will be missed.
All right. Again, join us. Hopefully next week we will try to keep it more positive. I don't know.
We were positive, and now we're not. Positive.
I thought we were at the end of the show. It felt like an appropriate time. I'm sorry for bringing this down.
That's okay. I don't know how to end it out, damn it.
Just normally goodbye.
We pile off into something.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I'm stopping it.
You should.